Good morning. Welcome to California. My guest on today's programme is a San Franciscan by adoption who's never quite managed to shake his Brooklyn accent, probably by choice. Dan Cassidy was born in New York in 1943 into a thoroughly Irish-American family. He's been a seaman, a musician, a filmmaker, an academic, and most recently a student of words. Familiar words whose origins are obscure. The great American writer H.L. Mencken in his 1937 book, The American Language, said of the Irish that they gave American very few new words, perhaps speakeasy, shillelagh and smithereens exhaust the list. Dan Cassidy begs to differ, and in his new book, How the Irish Invented Slang, The Secret Language of the Crossroads, he's compiled a dictionary of familiar American argot and sets out how he thinks Irish Americans have actually greatly enriched the spoken English of their adopted country. Dan Cassidy, you're very welcome.
Thank you, Miles.
Now, first of all, the Brooklyn accent, it seems out of place in laid-back San Francisco. Is that the way you like it?
Well, it's always identified me, Miles, although I must say, my accent and much of the vernacular that I learned as a child was sort of bad speech. It was the kind of thing that your parents may have spoken themselves, but as you were lucky enough, let's say in my own case, to become educated and to be the first one to finish high school and then go on to college, they encouraged me, as did my teachers, to squeeze it out of my mouth. Sadly, or perhaps happily, when I am feeling comfortable, when I'm with friends, when I'm with family, or occasionally when I get angry, it tends to come out. So while I've kept it inside a bit, it tends to emerge. Yes.
Tell me something about that Brooklyn upbringing. Did it happen in a very Irish-American neighborhood?
Interestingly, the Irish neighborhoods in New York were hybrid neighborhoods. We generally, even in the most Irish of Irish neighborhoods, we were only about 60%. But certainly in neighborhoods, I was born right near Irishtown, Brooklyn, which is where my mother's family first landed in the 1850s, which was about 60% Irish. So that was a very Irish neighborhood. It was called Irishtown in Brooklyn on the East River. From there, we moved to Sunnyside in Queens, which was another Irish neighborhood, and then Rockaway Beach, which was, I call, the Irish Palm Beach, where my father owned a saloon called the Innisfail. We didn't say Innisfail. We said Innisfail. So they were very Irish neighborhoods with Irish bars, Irish social clubs, county organizations, and Irish speakers in all of them.
And I'll come back to that in a minute because that fascinates me. But were they the kind of neighborhoods in which you had to be able to look after yourself?
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to look out for yourself, of course. I mean, New York is New York, Brooklyn is Brooklyn, and these were mostly working-class neighborhoods, people that work for a living, working stiffs, to use an Irish word, stiff, a big, hulking person, right, S-T-A-F. And it was working stiffs, women and men, and they were a tough lot, but they were toughness without swagger. It was an internal toughness of many immigrant peoples have, I think.
Were they poor but honest neighborhoods, or was there a certain amount of criminality going on?
Both. The old Irish dialectic, not either or, but rather both and. They were hardworking neighborhoods, as I said earlier, with lots of working stiffs. Most people worked. Many of the women worked even back then, well before the feminist movement. Matter of fact, they all worked. But yes, there was absolutely criminality, what was called criminality. Many of the underworld occupations that the Irish did get into are legal today, like gambling and like selling alcohol. Both back then were illegal. The Irish made millions from it and from gambling, and today they're multinational empires. And the presidents and CEOs of these companies can sit in presidents' cabinets. So who knows, if only Madden was alive today, he might. I like to think he wouldn't be in our current president's cabinet.
You would have been in Bill Clinton's
cabinet.
Bill
Clinton's, perhaps, yes.
Yeah. Now, the Irish language, the use of the Irish language, I would have assumed that it would have died out long, long, long before you were born in the 1940s.
You know, interestingly, the last U.S. Census reflected 25,000 native Irish speakers in the United States today. Irish has had, and that's in the census, so anyone can look that up. That's not Dan Cassidy. 25,000. Back as late as early as the 1850s, there may have been at least three quarters of a million Irish speakers. In New York, there were brick-geltocht neighborhoods, mixed Irish, English-speaking neighborhoods. Irish was spoken all over New York, Boston, San Francisco, Philadelphia, Chicago. The Mission District had a neighborhood, Irishtown. As late as the 1920s, there were thousands of Irish people who either their parents spoke Irish or they spoke Irish themselves. So it was fairly common, but not commented on or has not been studied by academics at all.
Mm. And tell me a little bit about your family. You had some very interesting uncles, Ranny, Dukey, Johnny and Matty. There may have been more, I don't know, but those I've read about.
Well, everyone had a nickname in my family. Most of them were English names. I mean, we called my Uncle Ranny Smokey because he smoked Lucky Strikes. But some of them were interesting. My Uncle Dukey was a boxer, and they called him Dukey. And as many Irish speakers know, the word Dukey, or T-U-A-R-G-A, means a big hulking guy with big shoulders. And he spent his living duking it out, which I think is just from the Irish word duking, which means hammering, thumping, pounding it out. So Dukey, and my grandfather's nickname was the big mystery in the family, though. That was Bolivar.
Bolivar. Now, that's to me, sounds like it's spelled B-O-L-I-V-E-R. It's spelled whatever way you want to spell it, but what exactly does it mean? What did you discover it meant?
Well, I couldn't figure it out as a kid. They generally wouldn't use it in front of my grandfather, but, the women would refer to him, as Bolivar coming home pretty soon, or my nanny would say, I got to go cook Bolivar a supper. And to me, it always sounded like the name of some Park Avenue swell, some guy that had grown up, Duke Bolivar of Brooklyn. Didn't make any sense. Until many years later, when I had literally inherited a small Irish pocket dictionary, and one night in April 2001, was looking through the dictionary, and there was the word Bolif and Bolivan and Bolivar, and it meant a mute, inarticulate, silent person, and that was my grandfather. He was a man of very few words, as opposed to his brothers, who could talk the head off a keg of beer at 100 yards.
Now, music was one of your careers. Were you musical from a very early age? Were you playing instruments from a very early age?
Yeah, my whole family was musical. Back then, in Irish-American working-class families, what you did on the weekends, there's a scene that we didn't all go to saloons. We stayed at home, and often we would sing together. There was a lot of singing in the family. Nobody played musical instruments in the older generations. They couldn't afford them. But as soon as I was 8 years old, my parents started me on the B-flat clarinet, much to their regret after a while. But I got pretty good. My brother played the trumpet, and my sister got piano lessons. So that was part of their whole project about education. And they saw music as a part of that. So,
and you had a very interesting encounter very early on in your musical career with a tall, thin tuba player.
That's another interesting story. My father had a friend, Frank Daly, who was a lawyer in Brooklyn, who had gone to New York Military Academy, which is a prep school for West Point. And he found out that you could get musical scholarships there if you'd play in the band. And I was a pretty good little clarinet player by 12. And in fact, I went off to New York Military Academy at the age of 12 on a full music scholarship. And lo and behold, there was a guy there, about 5 or 6 years older than me, whose nickname was Ichabod, from Ichabod Crane, who was, because he was so thin, and he played the tuba, and it's Francis Coppola, the film director.
And how long did you know him for?
Not that long, about a year, his senior year. Even back then, he was a director. We had an annual show that they put on at the military school called Yay Furlough, because you're going on furlough. And believe it or not, Francis Coppola was actually the director of Yay Furlough, which was an excuse for a lot of military officers, actually, to dress up in drag.
And at what point did you then begin to gravitate towards rock music?
I was always into rock music. It was in the neighborhoods and in New York and on the radio. Originally, it was what we call doo-wop music, R&B, guys like Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, and these local neighborhood groups that sang on rooftops and sang on the stoop. So we sang this stuff, and it was born in the African-American community. But the Irish, the Italians, and others, we picked up on it as well.
Now, you are a smart kid, and your parents obviously want you and educate you. You go to college, you go to Cornell, of all places, but that's something of a culture shock for a kid from Irish town in Brooklyn.
It was more, the education, for me, going to Cornell, I was 17, so I was pretty young. I was sort of a year ahead in school, and it was more of a culture shock than an educational challenge. Frankly, I was, reasonably good at academics, I just took to it. But It was the, frankly, a word that's not used much today, but I'll use it. It was a class thing, frankly. I gravitated to a few other students there who also were the first in their family to go to college like me. And so there were a couple of Jewish guys, Italian guys, an Irish guy that we tended to pal around together even. We sort of recognized each other from across the room by our accents or by our cultural tastes, which was rock and roll and doo-wop music as opposed to Beethoven and Bach.
So did you have a difficult time there? Did you have a difficult time, not academically, but socially or culturally, in adapting to a place like Cornell?
I took to Cornell like a duck to water, actually, in some ways. Yeah, I mean, it was great. You got to remember, I'd been in a boys' school for 5 years. And suddenly, let me be very frank with that. I mean, there were women around. There were young women around. And so I love that about Cornell. But yes, no doubt in certain social context, it's something you didn't talk about. I can only talk about it now. I'm older. It was a sense of being uncomfortable, being different.
And were you made to feel uncomfortable? Or was that just something that you felt yourself?
Oh, there were certain fraternities and stuff you just knew you wouldn't be invited in just by... I mean, for instance, there was a guy in my class. I was second in my graduating class, and I was going to apply to Harvard. And everybody said, sure, you got great grades, apply to Harvard. And then my advisor, though, said, Dan, just be very careful, be prepared. And a guy who was about 22nd in the class, who had about a B-plus average, I had an A-plus average, he was accepted to Harvard, and I was put on the waiting list. And then really, ultimately, Cornell gave me an early acceptance my junior year, and I went ahead and went to Cornell. But you had a sense that class and where you came from, and especially if your father hadn't gone to college or hadn't gone to high school even, that you were different, no doubt about it.
Now, when you got out of college, the Vietnam War was in full swing. How did you manage to avoid the draft?
Well, when I got out of Cornell, I was lucky enough to get a job at the New York Times. I was interested in journalism, and at that point, I will confess, I was also writing poetry and short stories. And at 19, it's a little amazing looking back on it, I had managed to publish poems in the Atlantic Monthly and in the New York Times just when I turned 19, 20. Which was a bit of a phenomenon back then, to be that young. And the Times hired me, not based on my poetry, but based on the fact that I could put a story together. And I was hired as what was called a news assistant, which was a step above a copy boy, which I guess it would be the equivalent of being an assistant professor. It's like you're on tenure track. It's not guaranteed you'll be a reporter. And so, yes, I went to work for the Times for a couple of years, and then the war broke out. And I, frankly, joined the anti-war movement almost immediately. I didn't have to think, no more than I have to think about how I feel about the Iraq War. I was against the Vietnam War right from the very beginning.
And it, in a way, indirectly, or maybe more directly than indirectly, it actually cost you your job in the New York Times. What happened?
Oh, I ultimately got busted in a march on Fifth Avenue. It was about 200,000 of us marching down Fifth Avenue, and some guy called me some nasty names, and I was younger then and perhaps a little hot-tempered, and he called me a few names I didn't like, and I belted him, and we got arrested. And so I spent the night in Huskow. My father got me out, luckily. And the rumors got around. And let's just say the Times didn't fire me for it. No. But I was no longer at the United Nations. I'd been at the United Nations Bureau, which was a plum job for a young news assistant. And then I was suddenly on the lobster shift, which is the 12 to 8 shift, by the way, at 43rd Street as a copy boy.
This is 12 a.m.
12 a.m. to 8 a.m. They call it the lobster in New York, or the graveyard shift, yeah. And so I stuck around a while, and, you know, I was very fond of a lot of people at the Times, but I moved on to...
You got the message.
Greener pastures. I got the message. I was off tenure track.
You actually, in a sense, you moved on to bluer pastures, because also partly in order to avoid assisting Uncle Sam in Southeast Asia, you became a seaman.
I hit the road, essentially. I was in New York. It was 1967. The draft was breathing down my neck heavily. I'd been attending a few classes at Columbia, and that wasn't helping with the draft board. Graduate school certainly wasn't helping with the draft board. And frankly, I don't know how to put this delicately, I was walking down 34th Street one day in the summer of 67. Two young women were walking there. I said hello to one of them. Where are you going? And she said, I'm going to California. And there was a 64 Ford. They had parked by the road there. I had about $30 on me. And they said, you want to come along? And I said, yeah. And then she said, oh, we're just kidding. And then I said, well, I'm serious. Take me as far as Orange, New Jersey. And if you think I'm a weirdo, you can dump me out of the car or call the cops. But I'm just a regular guy, and I really want to go to California. And I went to California from 34th Street to L.A.
You've written a song about it.
I later wrote a song about it. Mm. Yeah, it's a true story.
So you were in San Francisco in 1967 during the Summer of Love. Tell me about that experience.
I think the Summer of Love is a little bit like the word famine in Ireland. I will never use the word famine about 1845, 1852 in Ireland. As everybody, Irish person, there was no famine in Ireland. Then only one crop failed, the potato. The Summer of Love for me was a summer of war, but I was there. It was a lot. The hippies were there. It was great. But I wasn't really into hippies very much. As I said, the war was more on my mind than love, I guess.
So you didn't hang around Haight Ashbury and listen to Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead playing on the corner of Haight and Ashbury?
I was hanging out in an Irish bar in the Mission District, I think, back then, and playing rock and roll in the clubs. But I was not going up to the Haight Ashbury, no.
So you weren't really conscious of this, what is now seen as this huge youth movement that was going on at the time.
No, I was absolutely conscious of it. There were hippies everywhere. You had them in your family. My sister had flowers in her hair and that stuff. My nature, the hippiedom didn't appeal to me. I was more into rock and roll and, as I said, the anti-war movement, and just wasn't my cup of tea.
Tell me about the musical career. How serious, how successful was your music career? You've shown me a photograph of yourself looking very, very different with, Zapata-type mustache and long, curly hair. This is, you were about 26, 27 years of age. But did you consider yourself to be a serious musician at the time? You released a couple of albums, for example.
Well, as I said earlier, I had started playing classical clarinet at 8, and then I learned the B-flat tenor saxophone and got into jazz, got into Charlie Parker, and got into Miles Davis. You couldn't be in New York back then and not get into jazz as well. And I also got into rock music and got into R&B. I was lucky enough, I formed a couple of bands in New York. You know, we played around a bit, and I was not a great enough musician really to be a world-class jazz player. And I was attracted more to R&B. So I got pretty lucky and put some bands together, and I got signed to a record deal in 1969 in New York with Little David Records, which was an arm of Atlantic Records, which was owned by a guy named Monty Kay. And they asked me to come on out to Hollywood and make some albums and tour with some people, and I got lucky and came out. So it was a lot of fun. It was another excuse to go to California, this time to Hollywood.
And at one point or another, you shared a manager with Michael Jackson and Miles Davis.
Well, it wasn't really Michael Jackson. No, he was a friend of, I should say, Michael Jackson's manager. Monty Kay was, yes, he had my manager had managed everybody from when he was a young man, Billie Holiday, Miles Davis. He later married, he Flip Wilson, the comedian, the Modern Jazz Quartet. His name was Monty Kay. He's pretty well known in jazz circles. And then he was also interested in some of what I was doing. I have no idea why. And he had worked with comedians like Flip Wilson and George Carlin, too. So he had jazz comedians and people doing sort of folk rock, which is really how I'd describe what I was doing back then.
And what kind of a scene was there in L.A. at that time, at the time that you were recording, which would have been in the early to mid-70s?
It was incredible. There was an incredible pizzazz, energy, jazz in the air, heat, passion. You know, it was the 60s, and curiously, even Hollywood had been transformed by this incredible upsurge. I don't like the hippie word. I have to say sort of an upsurge of liberation ideology and theology and thinking. And it was really positive. And we saw this in films and in music and everywhere. It was an incredible time to be on the West Coast and to be in Los Angeles. You had guys like Coppola, Scorsese making movies. You had the people like Jackson Brown and Sly and the Family Stone and all kinds of people. And it was just an incredible energy that was everywhere.
Mm. One of the things that you did in your musical career was you opened for comedian Lily Tomlin. How did that happen?
Well, I'd recorded a song called We Are the World. We Are the Children, actually. Which
Freudian slip.
Freudian slip. Real quickly, I did this song called We Are the Children in an album from 1972. And it involved a very simple children's lyric. And I used 100 children of local musicians and actors and people. And some really great sessions musicians came in. And it was these children singing this song I'd written, very simple children's kind of song, We Are the Children and We're Tired of Your War, We Won't Fight It Anymore. And I had the children singing in sort of a chorus, We Are the Children. And yes, later on, Michael Jackson did something very similar.
Entirely and utterly coincidental, we hasten to point out.
Lily liked that song, and that's how I wound up being lucky enough to open for Lily a bunch of times, which was absolutely one of the great experiences of my life, because she is one of the great comedians, as we all know, of the world.
Is it easy or is it hard to open for a comedian? I mean, people are coming along and they are expecting to see Lily Tomlin, and then, you know, this guy stands in front of them with a guitar and starts singing.
It's a musician's purgatory. Exactly. You want to get out there and sing a blues song about your girlfriend left you, and they're waiting to have, you know, Lily Tomlin or George Carlin or somebody come on to crack them up. But the money was good. And I actually loved Lily Tomlin. I loved George Carlin. They were great people to work for. And sometimes you'd get over if you were good enough. And I was lucky. I had a big mouth, so I was loud enough, so I could usually get heard.
You mentioned Jackson Browne. You were you got to see Jackson Browne. You got to work with Jackson Browne. But also Warren Zevon. Warren Zevon died a couple of years ago. He was quite a character, wasn't he?
I mean, Warren was an incredible musician. I was lucky enough to be, I wasn't there for all the sessions, but for a number of the sessions with his first album that Jackson Browne did produce. And my friend Jorge Calderon, the great bass player, who later became a co-writer on some of Warren's greatest songs. I was lucky enough to be there and watch this all happen. Zevon was a character right out of any kind of sort of a noir novel in many respects. His songs reflect the kind of guy he was. And he was one of my favorite
songs like
singers.
Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, for example. I think that will tell people everything they need to know about Warren Zevon. Do you have a particular highlight of your performing or recording career that you want to share with us? Or?
You know, I mean, in terms of making my family proud and stuff, I guess it would be when I was at Carnegie Hall in New York. And that was pretty nice, doing Carnegie Hall. And then I did The Tonight Show, which was kind of another thing when my mom could sit there and see me on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. So those in terms were high points in terms of career, Carnegie Hall and The Tonight Show, Los Angeles Civic Auditorium, things like that. But then there's some nights I played in dive bars in the Lower East Side or in San Francisco that were just as good as Carnegie Hall.
Mm. How did you get into filmmaking?
I was always into film. I took some screenwriting courses in New York at the New School for Social Research before I left for L.A. And when I was doing music, I was also writing scripts and still writing a lot. And I was just lucky enough, again, it was lucky, I did a script called The Buffalo Road, which was this multi-million dollar epic, and the producer, Paul Witt, who I knew from New York, said, Danny, I love this screenplay, and he bought it. And like so many screenplays that even sometimes you make a fair amount of money, it came close but never got made. But that first sale got me in the screen Writers Guild. And once I was in the Writers Guild, and then I got an agent, and I started working and have been on and off writing screenplays for many years.
And were you able to make use of a previous association with one Francis Ford Coppola?
I did indeed. I mean, we ran into Francis again back in the 80s when I'd moved to San Francisco, and I wrote a screenplay called South of Market, which is about the Irish of the Mission District. And Francis loved the screenplay and ultimately bought it. As he said, Dan, I think this is the Irish Godfather. But unfortunately, again, it's like a litany, and any screenwriter, even very successful ones, can tell you for every one that gets sold, and there's very few that get made. It's hard enough selling them, and then even when you sell them for fairly substantial amounts of money, it's sometimes difficult getting them made. But yes, I reconnected with Francis then, which was really great to work with him. To work with a director like this and be going over in script conferences is unbelievable.
Now, to get on to your current preoccupation, how the Irish invented slang, you came to your study of etymology through a sad bereavement. You mentioned already this pocket Irish-English-English-Irish dictionary.
A folklopoca, as your audience knows, the famous folklopoca of Angoom, that's published by Angoom. I had a very dear friend, a young man, Kevin O'Dowd from Philadelphia, who was in San Francisco, had actually taken one or two of my Irish history courses. And he passed away suddenly at the age of 37. It was extremely tragic. He died very quickly. And he left me some Irish books in his will. It was the first thing that I'd ever inherited. And one of them was a little tiny folklopoca, a little pocket dictionary, which I was going to throw out because I said, well, I don't need this. I'm too old to learn Irish. So, you know, and my wife said, you know, Danny, you can't throw that dictionary out. It's a gift from Kevin, you know. And I thought, oh, geez, she's right. It's sacred. It'd be bad luck to throw it out, you know. And so Claire said, well, put it on your nightstand and look up a couple of words. And I actually did. And that's really what started it, this little tiny pocket dictionary that was left to me by a young friend.
What's the central thesis of the book?
It's a very, very simple thesis that the Irish invented slang by remembering the Irish language, without knowing it.
As simple as that?
It's as simple as that. It's the tip of our tongue and the nose on our face.
So let's look at then at some of the words that you include in this dictionary, whose derivation is known or disputed, but that you believe to be Irish. OK, start with the word slum, for example. I mean, obviously, the Irish lived in plenty of them when they came to the USA. It doesn't mean they invented the word.
I wish we hadn't, frankly. I mean, there's a word that I'd be willing to disown in a New York second. It is the most depressing word, in my opinion, in the English language, slum. And I say that in the book. But it is as Irish as they say, Paddy's pig, unfortunately and sadly. It's a part of our history that we wanted to desperately forget. And I think perhaps that's why we forgot even about the origin of the word slum, which is very simple, actually, in Irish. It first comes into the English language in the 1820s as a word for a very poverty-stricken room or terrible room, not a neighborhood. And, of course, in Irish, slum and shomre merely means this room is bare, bleak, naked.
Slum as in L-O-M.
L-O-M. Slum and shomre. And you were helping me pronounce shomre. Just a little earlier, I was saying shamra. But as an Irish-speaking friend of mine said, you know, Danny, you can't pronounce English that well. Why would you pronounce Irish very well? But Islam or Islam A, it is a barren, bleak place. Islam A, it is poverty. Lom, L-O-M, exactly as you know, means a bare, naked place or can also literally mean the noun poverty. So Islam is slum, and a slum is sadly, but interestingly and enlighteningly, an Irish word.
Okay, now then there's the word scam. Irish Americans have been responsible for quite a few scams in their time. Where do you think the word comes from?
Well, a scam is scam, or a scam is scum. C-A-M in Irish, as every Irish speaker, and even just people that took 6 months of Irish know, cam means crooked, means a trick. It's both an adjective and a noun. The adjective means crooked, and the noun means crookedness, a trick, a deception, a deceit. So again, scam A, just means it is a deceit. It is a trick. The word doesn't even come in as you to the English language until 1963. So it's a very new word, but in Irish, it's a very, very ancient word. It's just scam A.
So you reckon the Irish were using it long, long before it became current in the 60s?
Boy, do we know about scams in Ireland. We had one of the greatest scams ever pulled on us, which is called colonialism.
We're post-colonial
now. Post-colonial now. Indeed, thank you.
One of the first words of American English that I think I ever learned was the word phony, meaning false or insincere. How do you reckon that phony is derived from the Irish language?
Well, this is one that'll really, your audience is going to be quite amazed to hear. The Irish word for a ring, which I think is pronounced, and I wish you'd help
Fonia.
Me. Fonia, becoming phony. Now, if your audience must be saying, you know, this Cassidy's a real crackpot, that's not my etymology. That's the etymology in the Oxford English Dictionary. So anyone that has their OED handy, please look up phony, and you will see that the OED, it's one of the few words they derive from Irish, is from the Irish word fonia, phony. And it refers to the old phony scam, or the old phony ring drop, which was a scam that was pulled by people in the Seven Dials and St. Giles in the Irish slums of London, where you dropped a fake gold ring on the ground and then pretended to discover it with a mark or a sucker, and then you agreed, well, I'm in a rush, I'll sell you this ring for $50. Of course, the ring is worth a nickel, and that's the fonia or the phony drop. And that's the OED, not Dan Cassidy.
It's not Dan Cassidy. Okay. A couple of other ones. A word which is very much an American word, which wouldn't be familiar or too familiar in Ireland, would be the word uncle, to cry uncle.
Say uncle.
Say uncle. Okay.
Cry uncle. Right. Say uncle.
Which basically means I submit.
I give up. I give up. Surrender. I give up. Okay. Surrender. Mercy. Please help me.
Now, how is that Irish?
I used to do this to my, you know, look, I was an older brother, so I get my brother Michael. Later on, he becomes a champion boxer. This is before he becomes a boxer and a wrestler. You know, you get him, your younger brother, in a headlock. And then you'd yell at him, say uncle. And nobody wanted to say uncle. You know, boy didn't want to say uncle to another boy. Well, I mean, come on. That's just not all. I think some of the Irish speakers are already hip to what word I'm talking about. Again, you can help me pronounce it in Irish, but I think it's just unicle. Mm. Unicle, which just means mercy, quarter.
Unicle.
And that's all you're saying, mercy. Nobody wants to say mercy to anybody, but perhaps God. I don't know.
Moolah.
Moolah is a great one, and it's a very popular word. Moolah was a word we used along with simoleons and jack and all kinds of spondulics for money. Moolah, mole, was a pile, or gold or money. Moolah, a pile of gold. It's not rocket science.
Okay, let's say I concede what you've just given me. You've given me moolah, you've given me scam, slum, and so on and so forth. But a word like spiel. Now, spiel or spiel, meaning a pitch or a verbal presentation, surely that comes from German or Yiddish. I mean, spiel in German means to play.
You're absolutely correct, and spiel absolutely is from German and then into
Yiddish.
Gotcha,
it's not Irish then.
Ah, but spiel is from Scots Gaelic. Spiel. It's not Irish. It's Scots Gaelic. Anyone who has a Dwelly Scots Gaelic dictionary, which are, you can get in 1901, the Scottish word, and it's also an Irish word, S-P-E-A-L, spell, means a hoe, but it also means, and in Irish it means a hoe as well, spill, or to hoe, a spiller is a hoer. But also there's a whole page in Dwelly's 1901 Gaelic dictionary, which is devoted to spiel, meaning cutting, satiric, sharp speech, the sharp, satiric, cutting speech of a carny barker, a spill. So I believe it's spiel. I believe the other spiel has to do with spieling cards, spieling music, and means to play. And it's absolutely a word that's spiel, that's in slang. But I think the other spiel is probably from Scots Gaelic.
Okay, jazz. Now, you cannot take the word jazz away from African Americans. It is an African American word. It has to be. It's nothing remotely Irish about it.
Of course, I'm not talking about the music at all, which is African American music, and there's no doubt about that. There's only one problem with the derivation of jazz from anything that's African American. African-American musicians hate the word jazz. Sidney Bechet said the white man slapped that on our music in 1923. He said it's a word that has nothing to do with our community. Duke Ellington despised the word jazz and spent most of his life, along with Fletcher Henderson, trying to get people to call it African-American classical music. Every major jazz musician, from Sidney Bechet right down to Billy Taylor just a year ago on PBS, talks about the word jazz, and he says, that's not our word. That was put on our music. Ellington hated it. Bechet hated it. And he says, we still hate it. It's one of the worst things that ever happened to our music, that the white man slapped that word on our music. Actually, jazz is one of the easier words in the book for an Irish derivation. It was used in my family all the time. It had no reference to music whatsoever in my family. My grandmother used it. Whenever I get excited, I get passionate about getting, you know, to go to the movies or to give me an ice cream cone. And I'd go, you know, Nanny, Nanny, I've got to. She'd say, Danny, don't give me that jazz. Don't give me that jazz. It's just Irish heat, passion, and excitement.
Chess.
T-E-A-S, chess. And it first emerges in San Francisco in 1913 in the old Mission District. Many people don't know that, but again, this is in the OED too, folks. In the news stories of a young sports reporter by the name of Scoop Gleason, who suddenly in March 1913 begins using the word jazz to mean heat, passion, and excitement and energy, and applying it to baseball players and baseball and dancing and pretty much anything that's got heat. And that Scoop Gleason uses the word 40 times in March 1913, and the first cartoon comes out with the word jazz, which is located in the Mission District's old Irish town, and it's four Irish-American guys sitting in the stand, watching a guy run around the bases with a lot of jazz, and one turns to the other in the cartoon and says, he's full of the old jazz. And the old jazz is very old. It's the Jinniker, and it's the jazz, as I say, the jazz of Bridget, the sacred fire, the heat.
Okay, I am absolutely convinced. Now, you've already proved Mencken wrong. I mean, even with phony, you've proved Mencken wrong. And I mean, he doesn't even refer to words like Donnybrook, for example, which refers to Donnybrook Fair in Ireland, and here means a big fight or a big row. But in the process, are you not letting your imagination run away with you and claiming far too much American slang for the Irish?
Frankly, I think I've just touched the tip of the iceberg. As a teacher at a college, I'm hoping and praying that someone will pick this up. I think this is just the beginning of an understanding of the massive impact of the Irish language, and not just the Irish language. Let me add the Scots Gaelic language, the Welsh language, and other Celtic, so-called Celtic languages on English vernaculars, but not just on English. I think if we look into French vernacular, Spanish vernacular, and others, we'll find an influence, certainly, of the word pharaoh, for instance, being a very good example, the name of the pharaoh game, which is really just the turning game, and which is really, and emerges in France. And there's a whole chapter devoted to pharaoh and poker. So I think actually the net that I've cast is not much of a net. I mixed metaphors there. Let's just say I managed to see the tip of the iceberg in my own mouth. I think there's others that'll pick this up, and I think it's really out there. One of the interesting things today, a cultural phenomenon, is that the Irish Americans have been virtually disappeared in mainstream discourse in the United States today. Curiously, not by the old Anglo-conservatives, but today we find ourselves disappeared even by people who would call themselves multiculturalists, and yet they write us out. They put a white sheet, I call it a white shroud, of whiteness and say, ah, Irish Americans, they're just white. There was nothing white about Irish American history. It's a history of working stiffs, as I said earlier. And my father was orphaned at a very young age of Irish immigrants, Irish-speaking immigrants, I might add, and to come to Greenpoint, Brooklyn, and die under very tragic circumstances. He's in an orphanage in 1923, and one of his earliest memories as a nine-year-old boy is the Ku Klux Klan marching outside his orphanage. And this is in New York. This is not in Alabama. There were tens of thousands of Ku Klux Klanners marching all over New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut in the 1920s and torching Catholic churches and actually threatening Catholic orphanages. So if we became white, it sure wasn't in the 1920s when the KKK was following Al Smith all over the United States and over 20,000 KKK marched in New York in the 1928 Democratic Convention. And of course, as we know, Al Smith, a great man in my opinion, one of the great a man who invented the New Deal for Roosevelt. Al Smith only won one state, and that was Massachusetts.
As a New Yorker, how do you think you've adapted to living in the greatest city in the United States of America, San Francisco?
I love San Francisco. I feel privileged to have come here. I unfortunately will never shake, or not fortunately, never shake my roots in New York, my Irish American or New York Irish roots. But I was lucky enough to come to San Francisco and actually discover the great Mission District, the great Irish neighborhood there, where actually we have both Mission Dolores Cathedral, where the old recreation ballpark was, and where many Irish speakers were. So I felt like I went from New York City to San Francisco, and in many respects, they're two cities that are very similar. They have neighborhoods. They have street life in the streets. Some of the things I think that Irish large cities or large towns are famous for, and Dublin itself even, in the neighborhoods. Kind of a street life in the neighborhoods that I missed in Los Angeles, but I certainly found in San Francisco. So I felt like I was coming home in some ways.
Now, you teach at the moment in New College in the Mission District in San Francisco. It's an interesting place, and it's an interesting concept. Tell me a little bit about it.
New College's history is very interesting. We're only about 35, 38 years old. I think it's safe to say we were founded out of again, we talk about liberation theology. We were founded by a Jesuit priest and a number of Father Jack Leary and a number of teachers and students who had been at Gonzaga, a large Catholic university up in the Northwest, who had grown disillusioned with traditional colleges, whether they were Catholic or secular, and had founded a college which they felt the spirit lived best in a secular context, interestingly enough. So they founded New College to actually, believe it or not, to try and match some of the early colleges in Ireland, things like Bridget's Foundation in Kildare, which many say was an early university where pretty much any scholar could come and sit down and learn. And so I think that was the inspiration for many of the Irish Americans who founded New College of California. So it has both Irish and Catholic roots. Yes,
it's a very community-based college, isn't it?
We are what I would call a college, yes, that is very, very strongly believes in community roots for the college itself. We have a mission calling to work for a just, sacred, and sustainable world, to look for sustainable ways of keeping the planet alive and also for social justice and to find peaceful ways to achieve these ends. So we may be dreamers, but it's not a bad dream to have.